I must thank Rabbi Cohen and Purdy One and for the community here for a very, very inspiring Shabbos. It was spiritually uplifting. You know, when you speak somewhere, the way the speakers feel a lot of times is, of course, also is impacted a great deal upon by the response of the people in the community. And it was really, really very heartwarming to see the interest and the enthusiasm for everybody to deal with this important subject. Also, I'd like to thank, besides all the people here in the community and the shul, our own personal hosts, Rabbi and Dr. Lintz, and their family for hosting us and for being such gracious hosts. Thank you very much. The topic for tonight's talk is fortifying children's self-esteem. A while back ago, I was referred a 15-year-old boy from yeshiva in the Brooklyn area who had gotten into very serious trouble with the law because he had been caught molesting younger children. And I remember he came to me, and one of the important questions of the referring agency, of course, needless to say, was what was the risk that was going to happen again? So I addressed this question to this young man himself, and I asked him, I said, what do you think the chances of you doing this again? He looks at me and he says, I don't know. I mean, don't you think after I got into so much trouble, and if I do it again, I'll be in even more trouble, don't you think that would stop me? So I said to him, keeping in mind that he had been caught already once and that didn't stop him, and just knowing from the history of these problems, I said, you know, if you think that fear alone is going to stop you, you're making a very big mistake. So he says to me, so what would stop me? I say to him, a little self-respect. So he looks at me with the saddest eyes I've ever seen, with tears coming down his cheeks, and he says, then I'm really in big trouble. And indeed he was, because he was missing self-esteem, self-respect. I think almost all therapists would agree, although as therapists often disagree with each other on various things, I think almost all therapists, if not all, would agree that underlying almost all emotional disorders and problems is poor self-esteem. So I don't think it's just a passing fad, or I don't think it could even be overemphasized. And certainly from the perspective of prevention, which is what we're really trying to do, I think helping the children develop healthy self-esteem is probably the one most important thing you can do for them to prevent future emotional problems. But even more than just emotional problems, I think even for children developing spiritual health, self-esteem is probably one of the most important things you can do for them. The famous late Rosh Yeshiva of Mir in Yerushalayim, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, in his sefer Sichas Musar, has a chapter on Nichbadais, which could be translated, I think, pretty accurately as self-esteem. And he says there that being a tzaddik is not a guarantee against sinning, because even tzaddikim, ain't tzaddik shayasa tevel yechta. Right, there is no somebody who's so righteous that he'll never ever stumble and sin. And therefore, being a tzaddik will not in itself guarantee that somebody won't sin. He says the only guarantee against sinning is that you have so much self-respect that doing certain things is below your dignity. That's something you wouldn't even think of doing. The example I always think of, just imagine if somebody left by mistake a mop next to Queen Elizabeth. Do you think she might forget herself and start mopping? Highly unlikely. If you feel that something is below your dignity, then there's no way that you could do it. So even for a child's developing spiritual health, self-esteem is probably one of the most important things. At Shalosh Shudas, the Rav here asked a question and suggested that maybe we should address it. I don't think he's here, but I want to address the question since he raised it. He wanted to know why in all the presentations, sort of the assumption was, as he said, it was blaming the parents, and it's all focused on what the parents are doing wrong and what they should have done or could have done. And he said, you know, what about those cases where parents did everything right and nonetheless the children went off to derech and developed other problems? I just want to address this issue because I think it's true that, first of all, the first point is I don't think any of us actually use the term blame, and I think it's not just a matter of semantics, because I don't think that was really, we felt that that was the issue. It's not an issue of blame. It's issue that one who's going to help the child is the parents. So the question is what it is they can do to help the child. And also, especially when in relation to self-esteem, although many, many people and events in a child's life, in the present and in the future, will impact on their self-esteem, certainly, I think it's pretty clear and accurate to say that nobody will ever have as much impact on their self-esteem as the parents. First of all, they're the most important people in the child's life, and certainly in the earlier years of the child's life when his core, his bedrock self-esteem is developing, then most certainly the parents are the most important people. Another point is that it's really very hard for us to know, you know, what's really going on in somebody's house. You know, a person's public persona and personal persona are not always the same. My uncle, Rav Baruch, tells the Rosh Hashiva Zechayim Levrach, he writes in his Sefer, Abina Zabrach in Parshas Nayach, he says that every person, even the most highly respected, righteous person, is only a human being. And sometimes some negative aspects of their personality could be threatening to come forward and to be exposed. And they're certainly not going to want it to be exposed in public, and they're more likely to that it's going to find its expression at home. So we can never really assume that we know what's going on in somebody's house. But the most important reason why I emphasize what the parents can do is something that is exemplified by something that happened a while back ago. A mother came to consult with me about a problem she was having with her son. So she told me about all his symptoms, and I asked her, why do you think he has this problem? She says, well, I don't know, one of the doctors, family physician said maybe he has some sort of genetic problem. What do you think? So, you know, being sensitive to her feelings, I said, well, I don't know, you know, it could be some other issue, because some of the things she mentioned in the history indicated there were some problems between her and her son and the relationship. So I started speaking about it, but I was hesitant, I didn't want to offend her. So she caught on to what I was doing, so she stops me and she says, Dr. Sorotskin, you don't understand me. I hope you'll tell me it's something that I did, because then it'll be something that I can fix. If you tell me it's something to do with genetic or chemical, he said, that would be even worse, because then what am I supposed to do about it? So I think if we think as parents, you know, whatever the source of, the exact source of the problem, the ones who have to work with it is, of course, the parents. And therefore, that's why the emphasis is on the parents. What is the definition of self-esteem? What is self-esteem? My informal definition of self-esteem is the stable of acceptance of oneself in a general sense. In other words, it doesn't mean that you're perfectly satisfied with everything about yourself. It certainly doesn't mean that you feel superior to everybody else. It means that in a general sense, you're satisfied with yourself. It's not any difference when you say that you hold someone else in high esteem. Does it mean you necessarily love them? Does it mean that you necessarily agree with every single thing they do? No, it means in a general sense, you hold them in high esteem. And that's the same thing with self-esteem. I'd like to discuss, there's a few misconceptions that people have regarding self-esteem. One is that many parents really sincerely worry, and for that reason are very hesitant even to compliment their children, is because they're afraid that if a person has self-esteem, he would have no motivation to improve. After all, if you're satisfied with yourself, then why in the world would you have to improve anything? But as we said before, self-esteem does not mean you think you're perfect, and does not mean that there's nothing about yourself you can improve. It means that you feel that it's okay to be okay. You can still have aspirations, but those aspirations are not based, they're not the result of feeling not okay. In other words, if the baseline is that you feel okay about yourself, you could always want to build on that and improve. People who feel lack self-esteem, everything that they need, that they try to aspire for, is only to undo the negative self-image. Right? And that causes all kinds of emotional complications. And I would say even more than that, that feeling satisfied with oneself has the exact opposite effect. Rather than inhibiting people from wanting to improve, it only motivates them to get better. I think the very simple example of that is, if a kid loves playing basketball and he enjoys the way he plays, does that mean he plays less basketball or more basketball? Right? Most times if a person is satisfied with the game and enjoys it, he plays more. I'm not sure why we worry that if somebody's satisfied with himself and his accomplishments, he'll accomplish less. And in fact, in the Bryson Ovis says that from the Memches Dvarm Shatar Niknus Behem, the Bryson enumerates the 48 ways that a person acquires Tyra. And one of the 48 ways is Sameach Bechelkai, being satisfied with your lot. Most people learn that it's referring to in a person's physical acquisitions. If somebody is satisfied with his monetary state, then he will have, you know, he'll be more motivated to learn. But the Sfas Emes, and it's quoted by Rapan, says that it's also going on a person's spiritual acquisition. So we see clearly that what motivates a person to want to acquire more spiritual acquisition is actually being satisfied with what they have achieved. Also, many people are very concerned that if a child develops too much self-esteem, he will be arrogant and conceited. He'll become a balgaiva, right? And they feel it's almost incumbent upon them is to actually put the child down just to be on the safe side, to make sure that he doesn't become conceited. And there's even some recent research that seems to back this concern up, because there are people who have studied, you know, the people, the early proponents of the self-esteem movement, shall we say, you know, claim that many children who grow up to be delinquents or violent, it's because of poor self-esteem. So people actually study this, and they claim that they found that many delinquents, many juvenile delinquents, have too much self-esteem. They feel superior, they feel they have feelings of grandiosity, narcissism, entitlement. And so they say, you see, you got to be careful. Being too happy with yourself or holding too much of yourself could be dangerous. But anybody who's read the research carefully, it's quite obvious, I think also common sense tells us that, that anybody who needs to feel superior actually feels inferior. Anybody who's acting conceited does not have true self-esteem. It's a pseudo-self-esteem. It's a defense against poor self-esteem. And lest you think that this is some, you know, cutting-edge psychological theory, actually, the Rav Dessler in the Michta Melio, the famous Mashgiach, originally in England and then in Panovich, he says in the fifth chelik that came out, that was printed about a year or two ago, he says that the root of gaiva, the root of being conceited, is in rikshei nechitut, in inferiority complex. Right? So you see very clearly that the opposite, if you want to make sure the child does not become conceited, if he has healthy self-esteem, that's the surest guarantee against becoming conceited. So how do we build a child's self-esteem? As we spoke about earlier today, accepting a child for who he is, in a general sense, is the single most effective means of building a child's self-esteem. Now again, I want to reemphasize what I said, when we spoke about earlier, that loving children is a lot less crucial than accepting them. And many times when people speak about preventing difficulties with children, they speak about the importance of loving children. I found very rare the parent who doesn't love their child, certainly in the earlier stages. Sometimes after many years of problems, that love can become undermined. But certainly that was never the original source of the problem. The very rare is the parent who doesn't sacrifice everything for the sake of their children. In fact, it's very rare the parent who wouldn't give their life for their children. So I don't think it's love is the problem, but accepting a child for who they are is a much more difficult task, especially when there's a clash of personalities and things like that. There was a lady once, I don't remember if I said this over last time, but maybe there are other people who weren't here, and I guess I'll remind myself because I don't remember if I said it. There was a lady who once complained to me. She had a long history of problems with her child. And she had herself, she had gotten divorced, it was a very messy divorce. She had gone through a very hard life and had much problems with this particular son, who at this point was already married. And she complained why he doesn't call. She says, a good son, even when he's married and away from home, calls his mother every Erev Shabbos to wish his mother good Shabbos. And her son doesn't do it, and she's very upset. So I asked her, do you like your son? She says, well, you questioning my love for my son? Of course I love my son. I didn't ask you if you love him. I asked if you like him. She's an honest lady. She thinks about it and contemplates the question. She says, well, if I have to be truthful, I can't say that I like him. I do love him, but I can't say that I like him. I say, okay, but you expect somebody you don't like to call you every Erev Shabbos? Yeah. As I had mentioned, many children today, even children who are certainly adequately functioning, feel that they are a disappointment to their parents. We have set very high standards for our children in all areas. And usually, of course, a child only excels in those areas that we don't stress. Probably not a coincidence. Right? And in my opinion, it's this feeling of not being accepted by one's parents or being a disappointment to one's parents that is probably the major source of the most of the problems we have with youngsters today. There are, of course, other things have been mentioned. There are, of course, unfortunately, no lack of other type of problems. But I think at the root, even if a child has a problem, but he feels his parents feel that he's doing the best he can, or that she's doing the best she can, and that they're there to help him or her with their struggle, then it won't cause them half as much harm as if the child feels that his parents or her parents are disappointed in them. That's a terrible, that's probably one of the most painful feelings. When children talk to me, when teenagers talk to me about how much of a disappointment they are to their parents, there's more pain in their face and in their eyes than anything else that they've ever told me. When kids tell me that they're failing in school or have no friend, the look on their face is not half as painful when they talk about how they are a disappointment to their parents. Now, what's most amazing is so often kids are actually doing pretty well. I'm not talking about the kids who are, God forbid, on drugs or got thrown out of, you know, five schools. Some of the kids are doing well, but not doing as well. I remember there was one young man whose father, who for some reason was obsessed that his son become a doctor. Now, this young man had a minor learning disability, nothing that drastic, but just going through pre-med was like absolutely torture for this young man. And why in the world, like, he had to be a doctor, dafka a doctor, you know? Like, nothing less than that would satisfy his parents. But when I suggested to him that maybe he might want to consider some other options for a career rather than being a doctor, like, he was horrified at the thought, like, what would his father, like, how could he disappoint his father and do this to him? The antithesis of acceptance is criticism. I think it's the poison of self-esteem. When it's excessive and unreasonable and not balanced with praise and acceptance, it totally undermines self-esteem. Now, unfortunately, there was a young lady once who I was seeing who told me that her mother told her, when she complained once to her mother that why does she always criticize her, her mother was like shocked. She says, what are parents for if not to criticize? And I think the reason, she was a nice lady, this isn't that she enjoyed torturing her daughter, but I think the reason is because she didn't have a relationship with her. You know, every parent feels it's their job to do something for their child. They have to influence them in some way, because that's certainly what is a parent for, if not for that, to guide, to teach your child. If there is no positive way of doing it, if there's no relationship, then, you know, the parent, what should they do? Nothing. They might as well retire. Right? They have to do something. So then, if nothing else is left, then criticizing seems to be, that's everybody can do. Criticizing is not so difficult. Developing a relationship is already complicated. There's also a lack of balance. You know, there's a lack of balance. I wrote an article about this once, and I wrote like this, that some parents criticize their children as if they never loved them, and love them as if they never criticized them. You know, when the child is bringing you nachas, there's nobody like him in the world. You brag to everybody in the city about it, right? And as soon as he does one thing wrong, then you totally forget anything that he ever did right, and it's all, you know, all black. And that is extremely confusing for a child, and it makes it very difficult for them to develop healthy self-esteem. A very important point about developing self-esteem: providing children with opportunities for success, contrary to public opinion, will not by itself build their self-esteem. Even when children already have problems with self-esteem, very often parents and certainly teachers feel that the solution is to provide them with opportunities for success. And it seems to make a lot of sense, and, you know, intuitively it makes sense. He feels bad about himself, so if you give him opportunities for success, that certainly should improve his self-esteem. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way most of the time. The ability to transform achievement into self-esteem is not inborn. It doesn't happen automatically. It has to be developed. And I can prove it to you, because I can be pretty sure that every single person here in the audience probably knows at least one person who's tremendously successful and has no self-esteem. You know, if you think about it. And not only do they have no self-esteem, they very often don't even have self-esteem in the area that they are renowned for. And how is that possible? If success itself creates self-esteem, then how could these people not have self-esteem? And I think there are three reasons why this happens. Self-esteem can only develop, by definition, if there's a focus on the self. That's what self-esteem is. It has to come from the person's sense of themselves. Sadly, in many homes, the emphasis is not on building the self, but on impressing others, including bringing nachas to your parents. If a child grows up in a home where that's the purpose in life, like I mentioned last time, you go to any bar mitzvah, that's a bracha they give every bar mitzvah bracha, right? You should bring nachas to your parents as if that's the purpose in life, rather than bring nachas to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Right? So if that's a child's purpose in life, is to bring nachas to his parents, right, and to impress other people, then there is no focus on the self. The whole focus is on other esteem. There is no self-esteem. It's to make sure that everybody else is impressed with you. Now, there's one big problem with trying to impress other people. It is so difficult to be certain that you impress them. If the focus is on yourself, and you have standards that you've internalized from your parents and from your teachers, you can measure yourself by your own standards. So you know how well you're doing by your own standards. So it's a little bit easier to feel confident with your self-esteem. But if you have to impress others, how in the world can you be certain? They may look like they're impressed. Maybe they're only trying to make you happy. Maybe the guy's a tzaddik. You know, he always likes to make everybody happy. People have no self-esteem. You know, even if they're complimented, they can shoot down any compliment very easily. They never believe it. Oh, he's just trying to make me feel good. So such people need constant input from others to reassure themselves that they have the approval of others. And that's by definition somebody who's a show-off, who's conceited, that makes a balgaiva. So you can't have self-esteem if the focus is not on the self, if it's only to impress others. I always feel when a child tells a parent, you should be proud of me because I did such and such, you should answer him, you should be proud of yourself. And that's what you want to help them build, self-esteem, not other esteem. There was once I was working with a 19-year-old young man who, but when I first saw him, he already was suffering from serious depression for about 5 years. He had been on every antidepressant known, and none of them had any effect on him whatsoever. At one point, I met him and his father. So this young man, he used to be the star student. Before he became depressed, he was a star student in his class, in his school, both in learning, academically, in sports, in popularity. He was like the perfect child. And he told me, and his parents were very highly successful people in their area, very well known and very accomplished. And at some point he realized that in his family there's a tremendous emphasis on impressing other people, and that he's exactly the same way. And he never ever did anything for its own sake, or for himself, for his own development. Everything in his life was done to impress other people. So I went to have a meeting. He asked me he wanted to meet together with his father. We meet with him, and he tells his father, with a very sad look on his face, and he tells his father, you know, I realized that I never, ever did anything for any reason other than to impress other people. So his father turns to me with a very perplexed look on his face. He says, so what's the problem with that? He says, everything I do till today is to impress other people. Why is that a problem? Like, it motivates me to do a lot of things. Now, one of the big tragedies and I think I mentioned this also before, that one of the big tragedies of doing things to impress other people and wanting to please one's parents and being worried not to disappoint them is that the children do not turn for their parents for help when they have a problem. Because after all, you can't disappoint them, because that's terrible. You're not allowed to disappoint them. And therefore, as Dr. Pelkovitz had mentioned that research, I wasn't aware of that research, I just knew from clinical experience, that it shows the gap between the time, for somebody did a study of this, how much time was there from the time that a child had a problem in the Frum community. I think this was with Orthodox people, if I'm not mistaken, he said. Yerushalayim, yeah, with the Haredish families, right. The amount of time that lapsed between when they asked the children, how much time was it from when you first experienced this problem until you told your parents, until your parents realized it, or until your teachers realized it? And I think they said it was like 4 or 5 years. And I think one of the reasons for this is because the children feel terrible. How could they tell their parents' job is not to help them, their parents' job is to have nachas from them, so how could you disappoint them? Once children develop poor self-esteem, trying to reverse it by complimenting them usually doesn't work either. Have you ever tried complimenting somebody who doesn't have self-esteem? It's a totally impossible job. It's like trying, you know, the example I think of is what happens when you drive a car after it ran out of oil and you burn the engine. I know from personal experience, I've done it twice. Right? The first time it happened, the mechanic told me the news. I said, like, and why isn't the car running? He says, well, you drove without oil and you burned the engine. I said, no problem, put in plenty of oil, it's on the house. He says, well, it's too late. The engine burned out. You have to strip the engine now and rebuild it, which is quite an expensive proposition. I didn't learn from experience, it didn't happen a second time. So same thing, when once a person grows up without self-esteem, it burns out his internal psychic engine. And usually in order to repair it, just putting in oil of compliments doesn't work anymore. Usually without therapy, usually it doesn't work. And there's a reason for that. There's a term in social psychology, cognitive dissonance. And actually, before the social psychologists knew about it, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz talks, he brings up from the Shulchan Aruch, Chazaka Ovid Inchi Lazuki Dibure. A person doesn't like to change their mind. If somebody has a certain strongly held belief, they don't like to change it, even if it's negative. Even if they suffer from the belief. And actually, there's a recent research, somebody with a very interesting experiment, that people who had negative feelings about themselves, and then they did a task, and the results can be interpreted positively or negatively toward themselves, they prefer to interpret it negatively rather than challenge their negative assumptions about themselves. Now, this is not because people enjoy not liking themselves, hardly that, but rather because if that's the way they've lived their lives and set up their lives and their reactions with a negative attitude to oneself, it's more painful to try to change it than to just reaffirm that belief. And that's why it's really just plain success will not, because they won't interpret anything as success. And that brings me to my second point of why success itself won't build self-esteem. Because the question is, how do you define success? When parents are very critical and very perfectionistic, right? So the definition of success has been distorted in the child's mind. To him, success means doing it perfectly well. I've heard from a few Beis, I once spoke at a Beis Yaakov convention, and some of the teachers told me that when they give a girl, especially the better student, a 98, the girls can burst out crying something like they got a 40. Right? Because to them, 98 is defined as a horrible disaster, a failure. So when you define success in those terms, how could they ever be successful? How you can't get 100 then? Not only that, it's even worse than that now, because sometimes they give extra credit. So you can get 110. So getting 109 is an unmitigated disaster. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that the children, they internalize these attitudes. One youngster just recently told me, it just happened. He tells me, I said to him, it's a shame that you've been that your parents criticize you so much. It seems to have had a very negative effect on you. So he looks at me strangely and he says, parents who don't criticize is just because they're lazy. So he's internalized. That's the job of a parent. A parent doesn't feed their children is lazy, so a parent who doesn't criticize is lazy. They've internalized. They become their biggest self-critics. So what happens is that there is no achievement. How can they have success? You may define it as a success. I know this when I work with my patients trying to build a self-esteem, and they'll describe something, especially in the area that they have difficulty, and they'll describe how they overcame a problem that maybe before they weren't able to overcome, or they took a step in the right direction. And if I try to say something good about it, it's unbelievable. They trivialize it. They minimize it. No, I was just lucky, and the other people do even more, and I shouldn't have had the problem in the first place, so what does it mean that I overcame the problem? You know, all kinds of lumps of charades. And it's like, it's impossible for them to even see it as an achievement. In fact, it's so bad that I coined a phrase for it. I say that they are experts in snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Now, this issue is not just a problem of poor parenting. You know, studies have actually shown that, you know, many of the parenting classes that try to teach parenting techniques are not usually so successful because they're underlying assumptions and attitudes that are the problem and not techniques. A parent needs to have a positive and a contextual perspective of their children's behavior. Somebody made, there's a guy named Strasberg that made a fascinating study. He took mothers of children with behavior problems and a group of mothers with children without behavior problems, and he showed both of them vignettes, like video clips, of a typical childhood behavior. So for instance, a little kid playing with his toys, and the mother says, "Okay, Johnny, now put away your toys, it's time to go to sleep." So how does Johnny react? "Oh, come on, Mommy, I'm over the game, let me play." Right? And they asked these mothers to describe what they saw, just describe the scene. So the mothers with children without behavioral problems described this as a typical child with a behavior. The mother wants the child to go to sleep, and the child doesn't want to go to sleep, and you know, you have to convince him to go to sleep or get him to go to sleep. The mothers of the children with behavior problems described the scene in terribly negative terms. This is a child who's rebellious, he's a big chutzpahnik, or whatever the English equivalent, and others' authority and all kinds of other malicious intent. So is it any wonder how, according to their understanding of the situation, they're reacting very normally? There's absolutely nothing wrong with their reaction. The problem is in their perception and not with the reaction. Rav Volber writes in his Sefer, Zriu Binyan B'chinuch, he writes that to expect a young child to sit at a Shabbos table throughout the meal is a totally unreasonable expectation. And how many people, parents, don't try to force their kid to sit by the Shabbos table? So he should develop a positive attitude to the Shabbos table. How exactly, I'm not sure, but that's what they want. Another very point regarding criticism is that love and good intentions do not negate the devastating impact of unreasonable and relentless criticism on self-esteem. A while back ago, a mother called me from out of town. Her son was learning in a Brooklyn area yeshiva, and she wanted me to see him. So she describes all his symptoms and his problems. She doesn't say anything about, you know, the relationship at home. So I asked, I said, how's his relationship with you? So she tells me. And then I ask her, but she didn't say anything about the father. So I said, how's his relationship with his father? So she pauses and then sighs. I already was getting a picture. And she says, well, his father is a very unsuccessful person, and he takes out his frustrations on the children, or he used to. And he was extremely harsh and critical and punitive, and he used to punish him and yell at him and hit him, and nothing he ever did was enough, and nothing he ever did satisfied him, etc. Then 2 minutes later, we're finishing up the conversation. She says, look, I've got to warn you. My son tends to exaggerate. Lately, he's been saying that my father used to be abusive to me. So I say to her, what do you mean he's exaggerating? You just described that, you know, that from what you just said, it seems that he was abusive. No, but he loves him and he only meant well. I'm not sure, you know, why loving somebody, meaning well, makes abuse not abuse. I didn't think for a moment that father maliciously intended to make his son's life miserable. I didn't have such a thought. I don't think anybody would. But it doesn't make it not abuse. And it doesn't make... in fact, in the last Jewish Observer, the one that just came out right before Tisha B'Av, there's a letter I wrote about a year ago. I forgot about it already. In relation to a letter that a mother wrote, and she writes there, she had written about a child who went off to Derech and came back, and she says, but she still doesn't forgive him. Even though she's very happy, of course, that he came back. Why? Because he made a conscious decision that children who go off the Derech, it's because they make a conscious decision to go off the Derech. And he said, parents, although sometimes they make mistakes, they only meant well, and therefore they don't have to apologize. You know, they don't owe apology. He owes an apology because he did it on purpose, and she does. You know, parents don't have to because they meant well. So it seems to me to be a double standard. And in the letter I asked if her husband would have insulted her but meant well, would she also not say that he has to apologize? I wonder. In order to build self-esteem, it isn't necessary, even helpful, to tell a child that he's special in the objective sense. Because telling somebody that he's the reason why you like him because he's super special and better than everyone else will indeed breed conceit. Then a child will become a Balgaiva. All a child has to feel is that he is special to you. He doesn't have to be special in the world. He could be an average student in school and yet could be very special to you. In fact, I had a thought. Ramatisil Salman was once speaking, and he was talking, he said that he brought, I think it's from the Chayyadim, if I'm not mistaken, he quoted him to say that in order to be Mekayim, to fulfill the mitzvah of honoring one's parents, Kibud Av V'Aim, in its full sense, it's not enough to just do what the Shulchan Aruch mentions, you know, you have to bring them food and bring them a chair, not sit in their place, but you actually have to think of them as being very special people. So the Ramatisil Salman asked, what if in fact they're not? You know, when he's supposed to be delusional and think that they're very famous people when they're just very simple, ordinary people? So he says, no, it's not really a problem, because to you they could be very special people, because to you they're your parents. So I was thinking that this works best if you do the same thing, if you set an example, right? If your children are very special to you, even though they could be very ordinary people, the ordinary children, then they will do the same to you, and you'll be very special to them, if for no other reason other than that alone, and even though in the world you can just be an average person. It seems to me that one of the most meaningful gifts parents can give their children is to help them feel proud and satisfied with their everyday accomplishments. There's a fascinating Rav Huttner says something amazing in the Sefer HaZikar. He says like this. He says, human nature is that if a person becomes a man of a Bal Madrega, he reaches a high spiritual level, he no longer feels a sense of satisfaction and happiness from being a Pashut Yid, from being a simple Jew. That's no longer a thrill. He says that's a tremendous tragedy, because even when you reach the highest spiritual levels, at the bedrock level, you still have to have a sense of satisfaction from being a Pashut Yid, from just being a simple Jew. That alone has to give you satisfaction. Everything else that you add on that is just an addition to that core feeling. I think it's this, if you have such an attitude, that helps children learn to appreciate their non-grandiose accomplishment. Some of my patients can only feel happy with themselves if they do something that catches the headlines. The everyday accomplishment means absolutely nothing to them. It has no positive impact on them. Which brings to mind, I saw in the same Jewish Observer, they just came out, there's a very interesting story. Somebody writes that he once met Rav Schneur Cutler, Zichrono Livracha, on an airplane coming back from Eretz Yisrael. So he took the opportunity to discuss with him. He wanted to hear stories from his father, from Rav Aaron Cutler, Zichrono Livracha, to hear stories about his, you know, during the war years, what he did for Hatzalah. It's well known that Rav Aaron Cutler was Meister Nefesh, Mamish, you know, for Hatzalah, saving the Jews in Europe. He gave his life for it. So he wanted to hear some stories. You know, he had an opportunity to speak to his son. So Rav Schneur told him, you know what, let me tell you a story about my mother. Because my mother had a sweet tooth, and she loved, you know, like the Europeans, you know, drinking, I think they just, the Litvaks did that, you know, they, or the Polish, you know, they like to have a sugar cube in their mouth while they're drinking tea. So this is his mother, it was a big pleasure. And when the war broke out, from that day on until after the war, she stopped drinking, taking a sugar cube with her tea. So at first, this person who was writing the article was a little bit perplexed. I mean, here we're talking about Rav Aaron Cutler, moved the world. He, what he did, like running around the country, pulling every string, trying everything to try to save people. And the Rebbetzin, you know, so she didn't take sugar cube. But then he realized the deeper meaning of depriving. She did not have the opportunities of those contacts, but something that she deprived of herself, you know, for showing her identification with the suffering of other people was a very meaningful thing. And the Rav Schneur obviously felt that this was a very meaningful story. And I think being able to appreciate in oneself, I think today, if any yeshiva bacher or any young lady did such a thing, and I would compliment her for any, certainly any patient that did such a thing with somebody with poor self-esteem, and I would compliment them for this tremendous sacrifice, they'd laugh me out of the office. Because it would be totally meaningless to themselves. So that's the second reason is why success itself does not build self-esteem, because people, they've distorted the concept of success. At a deeper level, I think there's a third reason. For healthy self-esteem, it's not enough to complement a child's behavior. At a deeper level, to acceptance is not only accepting the child's behavior, but it's accepting their humanness and their unique emotional reality. And that's, it is not treating a child like an object. Many children are objectified. The parents look at them as a combination of behaviors. If you ask them about their child, just reminding myself that this happened twice in my career, and every time it shocked me, both times, that a parent calls me up and wants me to meet their child. Okay, so they spend about 3 minutes telling me about the symptoms, and they want an appointment for the child. So I tell them, listen, my usual thing I do before I meet, once I meet the child, I have issues of confidentiality, so then I can only speak to the parents with the child's permission. So I say, I like to meet the parents first, so I can hear everything before the child becomes my patient. So I ask them, I'd like you to come in with your wife and meet you first. So what for? I said, I'd like to hear more about your son. But I just told you. Literally, 3 minutes. Can you imagine that they felt that they told me everything there is to know about their child? They told me all the behaviors, you know, it doesn't take that long, and there's nothing else to say? That's called objectifying a child, making him into an object, rather than a person. When you focus on a child's superficial behaviors while disregarding their emotion, this induces shame over being a human being and having feelings, and it totally undermines not just self-esteem, but the sense of self. One of the most glaring examples I had of that also, this is also a bit mind-boggling. I was speaking to a mother who came to me for consultation, advice what to do with her daughter, who was an older single girl. So she's talking to me and telling me about her daughter. So I say to her, you know, from what you're telling me, it sounds like your daughter is depressed. So she reaches into her pocketbook and whips out a picture of her daughter and puts it in my face and says, she can't be depressed, she's beautiful. Now, we may think it's funny, but I want to tell you, how many of us don't we all have difficulty believing somebody who's very wealthy could be depressed? Sometimes people tell me that. Sometimes when I tell a teacher that the student, you know, I think the student's depressed, they say, it can't be, his father's a multimillionaire, he has every toy in America. And if you think about it, even in our education, in our chinuch, you know, can you explain to me, it seems that it's not uncommon, let's say, for parents to force children to sing Zemiris, right? Now, exactly what is the point? Does anybody have an idea? Obviously, it's only behavior. Now, we believe that opening your mouth and closing and having voices coming out of your vocal cords has some inherent value, right? I don't think it teaches love for Shabbos or appreciation of the spiritual value of Shabbos. But what's even worse is when these behaviors are done in the name of self-esteem. I'll never forget there was a fellow once who was having terrible conflicts with his teenage child, with his teenage son. And so he came to me one time after a major battle with his son. They got into a big fight and the son ran away from the house. And I said, okay, so what was the fight about? So he tells me about the size of his yarmulke. What was the problem? You know, that he felt that the size was too small, and the son said it wasn't too small, and he wanted to measure the yarmulke. Right? So the son took off. So I said to him, you know, what exactly were you saying? And I know this fellow, he's an intelligent person, like, you know, and he has to also be a mechanech, among other things. So I said to him, like, what were you thinking? Like, what was the point? He says, no, I was doing it for his self-esteem. I said, well, how's that? He said, well, you see, if he has a small yarmulke, then his friends are going to look down at him, right? So if I make him wear a larger yarmulke, then he'll have self-esteem. So to sum up, self-esteem is the stable and general acceptance of oneself is very important, both for children's emotional health and for their spiritual health. Harsh and pervasive criticism is poisonous for self-esteem. Success only leads to self-esteem, one, if there's a focus on the self, two, if the definition of success is not perfectionistic, and three, the child's emotional self is recognized and cherished. And finally, accepting your children as unique feeling individuals who are special to you will enhance their self-esteem so they can grow up to be well-adjusted, dignified, self-respecting, and joyous servants of Hashem. Thank you.